In the aftermath of 9/11 attacks, Americans vowed to crush every terrorist group of global reach, including Al-Qaeda. Bush famously declared on September 20, 2001, that the U.S. war on terror begins with Al-Qaeda, but does not end there. The impudence was clearly evident. Amidst the chaotic evacuation at Kabul's Hamid Karzai International Airport 2 weeks ago, a Daesh suicide bomber blew himself up, killing more than 200 people, including 13 U.S. Marines. The ghastly incident underscored not only the vulnerability of ordinary Afghans, but also the U.S. failure to eliminate the threat of terrorism in Afghanistan after a 20-year-long military campaign. It also blew the lid off U.S. military industrial complex's sinister interventionism in foreign lands. As reports later pointed out, the Kabul airport carnage also bore testimony to America's horrendous war crimes and impunity in Afghanistan. Many of those killed in the ensuing chaos at the airport didn't fall to the bombings, but to the indiscriminate firefight by American troops. More civilians perished later in the U.S. drone strikes. So as some would argue, 20 years after the doomed military mission began, Osama bin Laden has won the war posthumously. American presence in the war-ravaged country, often described as the graveyard of empires, not only failed to wipe out terrorism, but bred it.
Hundreds of thousands of deaths there, millions dislocated from their homes, an increase in radicalization and terrorism, horrific corruption, including making Afghanistan the number one exporter of illicit drugs in the world. All of these things, you know, we've so-called achieved there, and we've spent trillions of dollars doing it. So everything that's been achieved, in my opinion, has been quite negative to the point of, I would say, evil.
The war in Afghanistan, launched by George Bush in 2001, remained an enigma for his successors. After invading the country and destroying it beyond recognition, Bush launched another costly military adventure in neighboring Iraq in 2003. His successor, Barack Obama, refocused on Afghanistan, killing bin Laden 10 years after the 9/11 attacks. He began a drawdown but stopped short of a complete withdrawal. Years later, Donald Trump signed a withdrawal deal with the Taliban, and his successor, Joe Biden, finally pulled the plug on America's longest war.
The chronology of U.S. military invasion of Afghanistan following the 9/11 attacks sheds light on failed strategy and botched mission that plunged the war-ravaged country into chaos and turmoil. On September 11, 2001, a 19-member Al-Qaeda squad flew four U.S. airliners into the World Trade Center and Pentagon. A total of 2,977 people were killed. A week later, President Bush gave nod to military action. On October 7th, the bombing campaign began in Afghanistan under Operation Enduring Freedom. On April 17, 2002, after the Taliban regime was ousted, a transitional government was formed in Kabul. Between 2003 and 2008, Taliban regrouped even as the U.S. troop presence surged. In December 2009, Barack Obama raised the strength of U.S. forces to 100,000. On May 2, 2011, 9/11 mastermind Osama bin Laden was killed by U.S. forces in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. A month later, Obama announced gradual withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. In 2014, the U.S. NATO combat operations came to an end, although it never ended. The period between 2014 and 2019 was marked by uncertainty. On January 28, 2019, the U.S. and Taliban agreed on a framework for U.S. withdrawal. On February 29, 2020, the two sides reached a final deal. On January 15, 2021, U.S. troops in Afghanistan dropped to 2,500. On August 6, 2021, Taliban launched an offensive, laying siege to Kabul a week later. On August 30, 2021, the last remaining U.S. troops left Afghanistan.
You're listening to The Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to The Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Now to have more insight, we are joined by Mr. John Kirvikau, journalist and former CIA counterterrorism officer. Before we begin, so glad to have you back on the program, Mr. Kirvikau. Sir, the failed mission in Afghanistan caps off 20 years of refusing to acknowledge the limits of American power. Could you say the response to the 9/11 attacks was poorly planned and incompletely executed?
Well, first of all, thanks for having me. I think that that the initial response, the initial U.S. Military response in Afghanistan was not poorly planned or incompletely executed. When you recall that the initial response was just to destroy al-Qaeda. We went into Afghanistan in October of 2001, and by December of 2001, al-Qaeda was destroyed. We should have declared victory at that point, and we should have come home. Instead, we didn't. We made a terrible miscalculation, a terrible mistake in December of 2001 to remain in Afghanistan and to try to build the country into some sort of Western-style democracy. The Afghans did not ask us to do that. The American people had no idea that that's what the government intended to do. And instead, what it did is it practically bankrupted us as a country. It resulted in the loss of hundreds of thousands of lives, including thousands of Americans, and it was a terrible policy mistake.
Sir, do you think the whole misguided post-9/11 global war on terrorism, which found expression in futile military adventures in Afghanistan and Iraq, was an emotional overreaction?
I actually do think that the response in Afghanistan and Iraq was an emotional miscalculation. And on the one hand, I can actually understand and I think explain why we miscalculated in Afghanistan. Iraq is a little worse, but in Afghanistan, you know, this was such a major national trauma for us. The 9/11 attacks saw the deaths of 3,000 Americans, and so upwards of 95% of Americans wanted to attack Afghanistan, to kill Osama bin Laden, and to make the Taliban pay for their support for bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Iraq was a different story, though. Iraq was a deliberate effort by the neoconservatives who were in charge and power in the White House to just make war on a country whose politics we didn't like. When a country is invading another, when a country is occupying another, it doesn't matter who the head of that country is, its citizens are going to protect themselves and their families and their property. And that was something that neoconservatives at the White House didn't understand. They didn't fully appreciate. And as a result, we were bogged down in two wars that nearly bankrupted us over the course of 20 years.
Now let's take a break from the questions and take a look at how the global media has covered the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks in the backdrop of America's disastrous war and botched exit from Afghanistan.
What started as an operation to eradicate al-Qaeda has ended two decades later with the return of its Afghan enablers to power. Rarely have so many lives and so much cash been spent on so little. It would be nice to think that U.S. politics will learn from this debacle, and both parties are complicit. But the story is far from over. America may have quit this forever war, but it will go on. There will be little time for postmortems as we come to grips with the implications of a rebooted Taliban. In his long war against America, Osama bin Laden has won a sweeping, if posthumous, victory. The U.S. reaction to the 9/11 attack he masterminded is like the cytokine storm that can occur when COVID-19 attacks us. The defensive measures our bodies mount go too far and damage the vital organs our antibodies were meant to protect. The 9/11 era began in Afghanistan, and now it has ended there in humiliating defeat.
Now, the American public initially rallied behind the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, but the support waned over time. Today, a vast majority of Americans have become critical of the U.S. foreign policy. So, what reasons would you attribute to it?
The issue is that literally nobody in the country thought that 20 years later we would still be involved in these countries. And so, over time, the vast majority of Americans began to oppose both wars, both Afghanistan and Iraq, to the point where now there's been something of a sea change in American politics, where people are far more isolationists now. We saw that with Donald Trump's presidency. People don't want to be involved in these entanglements overseas. And another problem is that, you know, we've made a lot of people very rich with our military budgets over the last 20 years. We spend more on the military in the United States than the next 8 largest countries combined. If you're an American who's struggling to pay the electric bill or the gas bill or to put food on the table or to put your children through school. And finally, after 20 years, people had enough.
So up to now, we've seen Taliban's stunning takeover, US's hasty withdrawal, the collapse of the Afghan government, and the new Afghan refugee crisis. So could you tell us, what does this tell about the American military interventions?
Yeah, the collapse of the Afghan government points to an intelligence failure, an analytic failure. President Biden said that the Afghan government could survive for 6 months. In fact, it survived for 6 days. He didn't make up that date. He was given that date by the CIA. The CIA got it wrong again. And I think the bottom line is that everything leading to the end of the U.S. presence in Afghanistan was a disaster. Now we have a hostile government in Kabul led by people who happen to be on the FBI's most wanted list, which is kind of funny and ironic. You've got a refugee crisis. You have American citizens who are stuck in Afghanistan and can't get out. What this tells us, I think, about American military interventions, and I apologize if I'm repeating myself, is that we never have a viable exit strategy. We don't know when the job is done, and we don't know when to declare victory and just go home. And we should have gone home 20 years ago.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Kiriakou for his precious time and insight. And as always, love to have you again on the program. Now, let's see how people have reacted on social media and cyberspace on 20 years since the 9/11 attacks and the Afghanistan debacle.
British journalist and broadcaster Piers Morgan says Biden's shameful Afghanistan disaster has made America look weak, spineless, and cowardly 20 years after the 9/11 attacks. George Papadopoulos, an American author and former Trump advisor, notes that Afghanistan will be run by the same group that was uprooted after 9/11, calling it intentional by Biden to humiliate the U.S. military. Afghan-American community organizer Halima Wali slams the U.S. for tearing apart Afghanistan and blaming it for 9/11 when Osama bin Laden was found in Pakistan and the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi nationals. Arjun Sethi, a U.S.-based lawyer and activist, says nothing will change the fact that Americans should never have invaded Afghanistan, stayed so long, withdrawn recklessly, and indulged in worse human rights abuses. American political scientist David Rothkopf argues that the response to 9/11 attacks was hijacked by opportunists with personal agendas that were ideological or industry-driven.
And that was our episode about America's misguided response to the 9/11 attacks and its humiliating defeat in Afghanistan after the 20-year-long disastrous military adventure. We shall meet again next week. So till then, take care.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. This is your host, Musa al-Bahadili, coming to you from your program Q&A on Islamic Beliefs. Joining us in the studio today is our dear friend and Sheikh Murtada Karini from the Islamic Seminary of Qum. Dear Sheikh, I welcome you and assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining us, dear Sheikh. Today's discussion is a follow-up or continuation of the previous program's topic about how the Imam Sajjad alayhi salam survived the tragedy of Karbala when even a six-month-old baby was killed. We mentioned among some of the reasons, and you will inshallah elaborate, that as we Shia Muslims believe there must always be a hujjah, a proof of God on earth. Following that, it is natural that should be a miracle that should save the Imam from certain death. One of them we said was he was sick. He didn't even participate in the battle. He couldn't even move. He was crippled. We also said that the enemies also mistook him for somebody else. They thought they already had killed Ali ibn al-Husayn, the Imam, the next Imam, but in reality he was still alive. And on this note, please continue the discussion, dear Sheikh.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you for that summary. I also refer to the fact that we see, according to the historical references and reports, that in some, cases, the enemies of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they also tried to kill Imam Sajjad alayhi salam as well.
Right.
At least it has happened in two cases. One of them was, as I mentioned in the previous episode, on the day of Ashura, after killing Imam Hussein alayhi salam, Shaykh ibn al-Jushan, he approached Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and asked his soldiers to kill him. One of the people said that, no, we are not allowed to kill this person. He's patient. He didn't fight us.
Because of honor, basically.
Yeah.
They're too honorable for that.
Yeah. And then, according to this historical account, Umar ibn Sa'd, he came and said that you shouldn't kill this young man and the ladies too.
Also, so because they also thought they already had killed the Imam.
Yeah.
It was done and over with.
Yeah. So this is one case. Practically speaking, the enemy tried to kill Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, but again, referring back to that divine, miracle, he survived. The other occasion is in the court of Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad in Kufa. When Imam Sajjad alayhi salam talked about the fact that his brother, that is Ali al-Akbar, was killed by the wicked people, Ibn Ziyad said that no, he was killed by God. Then Imam Sajjad alayhi salam said that it is Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala who, he recited a verse in the Quran regarding the death of all the people. And his answer made Ubaidullah ibn Ziyad very angry and furious, and he asked the people around him that take this man outside the court and just behead him.
Right.
But then it was the role of Zainab Salamullah alayha to save the life of her brother. She became very angry and, addressing Ibn Ziyad, said that, "Oh Ibn Ziyad, you have killed all of us," referring to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his family members and his companions. "If you are going to kill this young man, that is Imam Sajjad alayhi salam, then you need to kill me with him." or before him.
Kill me first.
Yeah. And also Imam Sajjad alayhi salam told Ibn Ziyad that, oh, Ibn Ziyad, are you threatening me to kill me? Don't you know that, I mean, to be martyred is a kind of honor for us? So this statement by Zainab salamullahi alayha and Imam Sajjad alayhi salam caused Ibn Ziyad to,
refrain from carrying out the execution.
Continuing, his command, and he asked Imam Sajjad alayhi salam and his Ahlul Bayt to be seated on a special house around the mosque of the Kufa.
And just a point here, she was able to do this because of how eloquent she was, because mm-hmm. she was raised by the father of eloquence, Amir al-Mu'minin alayhi salam.
Yeah.
And also because it was in public court. There were people in power, authorities, officials were there, and they saw how she was able to basically win an argument against him. He wasn't able to kill a woman as well in front of all of these people. He would lose too much face as well.
When people talk about the role played by Zainab salamullahi alayha, we know that some people call Zainab salamullahi alayha as at least one of two personalities who kept the tragedy of Karbala alive.
Right.
And we need to take into consideration the fact that according to this historical account, I think this is one of the most, if not the most important tasks that were done by Zainab salamullahi alayha. The fact that she was in this occasion the cause for saving the life of Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. So the point is that the question, as you mentioned, reads why Imam Sajjad alayhi salam was not killed. One of the answers is that the enemies tried also to kill him.
Right.
But, they did not manage, alhamdulillah, to do that in practice.
Questions and Answers in Islamic Beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir. Inshallah, inshallah,
inshallah, you'll find your way. And the next point is that when it comes to the tragedy of Karbala, some people think that all the men were killed except for Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. And this is not true. We have a few other people, according to the historical sources, both Shia and Sunni, which tell us that there were few other men present in the army of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and even fighting the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, but for different reasons, they also survived the tragedy of Karbala.
Some of his companions.
Yeah. Share the names and the stories of some of these people, because it also helped us to come to this conclusion that it was not only Imam Sajjad alayhi salam. There were a few other men who were also among the survivors of Karbala. One of them is Hassan ibn Hassan, who later became known as Hassan al-Muthanna. According to some historical reports, he was injured in the tragedy of Karbala. He was captured. And a man from the army of Umar ibn Sa'd called Asma ibn Kharja, he tried to kill him.
Right.
But for any reason, Umar ibn Sa'd did not allow that. And so Hassan al-Muthanna, he also survived the tragedy of Karbala. The other one is Zayd ibn al-Hassan, according to Maqatir al-Talibiyin, page 1119. He was also another sign for Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam. He was present in the tragedy of Karbala, but he survived. The next is Amr ibn Hassan, another son of Imam al-Hassan alayhi salam, according to Tariqh al-Tabari, volume 4, page 359. He also was present, but was not killed. The other name is Muhammad ibn Aqil, and also Qasim ibn Abdullah ibn Ja'far, according to Zahabi in Siyar al-A'lam al-Nubala, volume 3, page 203.
Right.
So these are among the family members of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
And they were, of course, righteous people who also participated.
Yeah,
they were injured, but they weren't executed or killed.
And when it comes to the companions of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, we see that there are also few people among the companions. They also were among the supporters of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, but they survived. One of them is Uqbat ibn Sam'an. He was, according to this historical account, the slave of Rabab, the wife of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. So he was a slave. He was captured on the day of Ashura and he was taken to Umar ibn Sa'd. When Umar ibn Sa'd heard that he's a slave, he said that he should be freed. So another person present in the tragedy of Karbala, but he was not killed. It's been mentioned in Tariq al-Tabari, volume 5, page 454. Another companion of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, his story is very interesting. We need to take a lesson from that. And that is the story of Zahaq ibn Abdullah al-Mashriqi. According to some books like Al-Kamil fil Tariq, volume 2, page 569, before joining Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, he made a condition. He told Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam that I will be with you as long as you have other people supporting you and helping you too. But if you are going to be alone, in this journey, then I need to be permitted by you to leave you. So I will be with you as long as you have many supporters. But if you are alone and I'm the only person to help you, it means that I will be killed, then on that time I will leave you.
So he doesn't want certain death or martyrdom.
Exactly. And this is very unfortunate about him, maybe.
Right.
So it's been mentioned that on the day of Ashura, when Imam Hussein alayhi salam maybe was the only man and all the other men were killed and were martyred, he came to Imam Hussein alayhi salam and told him about that condition. And Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam told him that you're right. Now, if you are able to save your life, then do that. From my perspective, you're allowed, you're permitted to do that. And it's been mentioned that hearing that, he, tried to leave the, land of Karbala. He killed two men from the army of Umar ibn Sa'd, and miraculously, he was able to save his life.
So he abandoned the imam, we can say.
Yeah, somehow. Not somehow, sure. And
sounds crazy to us who just want to be among these supporters, and then we have a companion, just like, I'm out, have fun. Yeah.
At least one of his benefits was that later he is one of the narrators of the tragedy of Karbala. So to this extent, he helped the tragedy of Karbala to be at least narrated, but for sure he has abandoned the imam of his time on that very crucial time.
Do we know if he ever repented or regretted what he did?
I didn't see any narration about his repentance, but he has narrated some of the stories of the tragedy of Karbala. Mm. Quickly, let me mention some other people. The other one is the slave of Abdurrahman ibn Abdullah al-Ansari. He says that when I saw that all the people, all the men are killed, I also escaped and was able to save my life. This has been mentioned in Tariq al-Tabari, so for sure he was not, devoted supporter of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. We have another person like named Muslim ibn Riyah, and the last one is Murqa ibn Thamama. So my point is that there are other men also present in the tragedy of Karbala, who also survived this tragedy, and they were not killed by the enemy. So we should not think that Imam al-Masajjad alayhi salam is the only one who was not killed by the enemies of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam.
Right. Dear Sheikh, I thank you for your time, and I thank you, dear listeners, for tuning in. We can only ask Allah that it'll be among the companions of the Imam, not among those who will abandon him when he arrives, inshallah. Yet again, this has been your host, Musa Al-Bahadidi, coming to you from your program, Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting to you from IRIB English Radio. Thank you for tuning in.
Inna fil jannati nahran laban. Inna fil jannati nahran إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا حب أهل البيت فرض عندنا وبهذا الحب لنا شنيحا
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. Beautiful city of Tehran, though a crowded city, is a perfect place for having tours. Tehran is a city which has both old and modern attractions once in a place. Some of the modern structures and monuments of Tehran are really spectacular. Today we are going to visit one of these eye-catching structures, Abrisham Bridge. Abrisham Bridge, literally Silk Bridge, with the height of 200 meters, connects Banader and Nowruz parks. This bridge is located in Abbasabad Hills in Tehran. Based on the comprehensive plan for Abbasabad lands, the construction of seven bridges has been pre-planned to be implemented in this area. These bridges have been built for the convenience of the citizens residing there, such as availability of cultural and recreational facilities. Abrisham and Tabiat bridges are part of this plan, and their construction has been completed, and they are operational now. Abrisham Bridge is a cable state bridge with modern architecture. This bridge weighs 130 tons. And can tolerate weight of up to 200 tons. Abrisham Bridge construction took about 1.5 years to be completed. I am now standing near Abrisham Bridge. From the distance I'm looking at the bridge, it's so beautiful. I really can't wait to go over the bridge and see this modern structure from a closer view. I am now over the Abrisham Bridge. On my right side, there is Abatash Park, and on my left side, there is Gumbadamina. Well, this bridge is designed for pedestrians, bicycles, and carriages. And this is also a perfect place for photography. Artists and enthusiasts can find amazing subjects for photography in this place. God, Tehran's view from over the Abrisham Bridge is really stunning. Just across from me, mountains of northern Tehran can be seen. These mountains are magnificent and have doubled the beauty of Tehran. The sound of laughing and cheering of people who have come to Abrisham Bridge for having fun is great and full of life. Some youths are busy taking selfies just beside me. Well, I think Abrisham is a really meaningful name for this bridge. The kindness and compassion of the people look like silk. Beautiful, delicate, and strong. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
Start.
Movement.
Speed.
Live in hope.
Toward the peak.
On Youth Station. Youth Station.
I am a Muslim.
I am a Muslim.
Islamadi.
Islamadi.
Allah my Lord.
Allah my Lord.
His word Quran.
His word Quran.
Muhammad Prophet.
Muhammad Prophet.
Praise be upon.
Praise be upon.
I am Muslim for all.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, boys and girls, and other life forms. Welcome to today's brand new episode of Youth Station. We're coming to you not live from IRIB English Radio, and in the studio with me, I have my brother in faith and humanity and co-host in the show.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh, and welcome to IRIB English Radio, and you are listening to the Youth Show. And I am your co-host, Sayyid Abdullah Al-Musawi.
So
at your
Sayyid.
Service.
How you doing?
Alhamdulillah.
You good, inshallah?
Can't complain. Always, as long as I'm alive, I'm good.
How old were you when you left home?
Maybe 19, 18. I got married.
You got married when you were 18?
Yeah, 17 actually. I spent a couple of years with my parents and then I moved out. I'm just trying to follow the sunnah. Because people will say, well, why so early? So the Ahlul Bayt, the Prophet, they were emphasizing on people getting married at even a younger age. Actually at Belul, which these days it would be a crime, literal crime, you will be in prison for it. So if you marry at 15 or 16, that's a crime in a lot of states.
Right. You left home because...
So I got married. I have a wife. I need to start my own life. So I rented a house, moved out.
How did you make a living at such a young age?
It was very tough, and I assume it's the same now. Nothing has changed because I was a student.
Uh-huh.
I was going to university at the same time. I have to take care of a house, so I had a job. So I would do night shift in the morning, go to university, come back home, sleep for a few hours, and then go back to work and do the same thing over. So it was a very, very hard few years of my life, but alhamdulillah.
Did it pay off? Do you think it was worth it?
Well, everything is worth it at the end of the day. Life is just experiences.
Mm-hmm. I left home when I was 16 also, but for entirely different reasons, thank God.
You can share with us if you like.
I left home because very normal, conventional reasons. I left home to study, to pursue my studies, and then...
So that's another reason for leaving.
That's definitely one of the reasons for leaving. And then, you know, one thing leads to another. You find a career path close to what you studied, close to where you studied, because it's usually interconnected somehow. I haven't seen most of my family in, I'd say, about 4 or 5 years.
Okay, so you don't find the need that you need to go back and live with your parents once more.
Actually, not find the need, I don't think I can anymore.
Well, that's a different story altogether.
Right? Because you feel like you're established as a person now.
Yeah,
you're an adult.
Yeah.
So and I firmly believe that other than spouses, no two adult is or should live together.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, each person has their own set of rules and set standards and what's right and what's wrong. This is how, you know, I want to live my life. This is how my home should be. This is what I'm comfortable with. And if we live with anyone else other than our spouse, which is supposed to be a partnership, it kind of just, you know, it's going to be chaotic. What other reasons can you think of? Okay, you left because you got married. I left because I wanted to study. What other reasons do you think are there?
Well, I mean, when it comes to leaving...
Leaving
your parents, obviously, you would have your own reasons. So either work, either study, either traveling, or either you just want to be independent. Like, you know what, I work. I could be 18, 19, and I could work, and I could own my own house. And I, you know, like you said, you need to have your own stuff, your own things, your own life as you imagine, as you vision it. So you move out to a new apartment and you rent to yourself. And sometimes maybe you get kicked out of the house altogether.
Yeah.
Right? So
definitely.
Maybe there's, you know, problem in the house and you get kicked out. Or sometimes maybe there's too much domestic violence in the house that you decide to run away.
Oh,
which
happens
to a lot of
which
people.
Which is sad.
Yeah.
It's insanely sad.
Yeah.
No
so
child
we have a lot
should
of,
have to go
yeah,
through
Yeah, we have
that.
A lot of these people these days. We have a lot of kids and youth who had to flee to shelters and stuff like that.
And, you know, often the situation doesn't get better.
And it doesn't. Once it starts as a violent house, it will always be violent.
Exactly.
It
and, like,
fixes.
Those children who flee their homes in order to find refuge elsewhere also, in most cases, they won't find a better place or any place.
Yeah.
But see, we talked about, all right, marriage, the tragic case where a child has to run for their life, studying, career, maybe, you know, if you've already studied like 4, 5, 6 years in college and then you get a job opportunity in, I don't know, Amsterdam, you'll move out, right? But does such a concept, you think, exist within Islamic definitions? Because you see a lot of cultures, they study, they get married, they have careers even, and they're still living with their parents.
Yeah, so I wouldn't say Islamic, because as far as I know, Islam does not set limitation on the age and time where you should be with your parents and the time that you should leave. Now, there's a great emphasis on making sure your parents are happy, because sometimes you could decide to make a move and that will really upset your parents because they're attached to you, they love you so much, and they don't see the reason that you're moving out is valid. So, for example, I say, Dad, Mom, look, you know, I'm working, I got everything, I just need to have my own apartment. And your
it
mom
depends
says...
depends on culture, for
yeah.
sure.
So that's what I'm saying. So Islamically, we don't have such limitation. And then culturally, yes. But for example, you know, because I brought that example, because if that's going to upset my mom, so Islamically say, you know what, put your interests and you
on
want
hold.
Obviously.
I mean, Islam doesn't
obviously.
Necessarily emphasize on you having to stay with them for the sake
yeah.
of staying with them.
Yeah.
But Islam does emphasize on you catering to their needs if they are at a stage in their lives where they can't take care of themselves.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that doesn't exist in a lot of Western. I emphasize on Western.
Western
because
countries
that's how
don't
it is.
Have that. In Western countries, it just became like a norm.
Mm.
Like 18, that's.
In fact, if you're not out, it's kind of weird.
Yeah, it kind of they make fun of you.
You still live with your parents?
Yeah, it's became a stigma these days.
We'll leave that part of the discussion for after the break. We're gonna be right back. Don't you go anywhere.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Youth Station.
You're back here on Youth Station with me, Zainab, and my co-host, Sayed Abdullah. Thank you so very much for joining us again. We've been talking about how old were you when you left home? In all honesty, wouldn't you say, as a person who moved out early in life and went through some hell of a journey in character building...
Mm-hmm.
Being independent so early on in your life made you a richer, fuller, more...
Of course it does. Once you face life head on yourself and you get to suffer the pain painfully and slowly, it does make you stronger. What does not kill you makes you stronger. So it's definitely an experience. It definitely makes a person out of you, a man or a woman. Because you get to see what life is meant to be. That, a lot of the kids, and or even adults who grew up in their parents' houses all their lives, and they just had it like, you know, with a silver spoon in their mouths. They just weak people. Sometimes they just can't handle the simplest pressure of life.
Definitely.
But when you move out, and for days, for example, you don't have food, or you're out of money, or you can't pay a rent, or you can't pay the bills, and you feel that pressure, you feel that pain.
Mm.
Obviously, it makes you a better person.
Yeah. It makes you a stronger person. I'm not sure if it makes you a better person, though.
Well, stronger person is a better person in
no,
a way.
Again, no. I don't necessarily agree with that. A lot of people
no, so we're
went
saying
through a lot of...
being good, we're not talking about the virtuous good. Like, I mean, like, good in the sense that it increases something in you, at least your tolerance to pain. That's a good thing, right?
No, I don't agree with that either. Oftentimes, people,
we agree to disagree.
In order to be more tolerant of pain, they develop a thick skin, a strong shell, a big, huge guard. They become dysfunctional in terms of forming
healthy
relationships.
So you're just looking at the negative side of it, but
no,
the
that's,
positive
no, no,
side
that's
of
what
it.
I'm saying, Sayed. That's what I'm saying. I'm saying being stronger doesn't necessarily equate being better.
Yeah, well,
or being
not
more
always.
Tolerant
obviously
of pain isn't
to
equivalent to being a good person. You know, sometimes you're a crappy person because you've been through a lot of crap, right?
Wow. Mm.
Moving
so
forward.
So it didn't add anything to you.
Yeah, exactly.
So I said if it adds.
Let's explore more the different dimensions of what happens to a youth when they leave their homes early on in life. Let's talk about the cons. The pros are independence, character building, experience, which is, you know, usually all good stuff, usually. But the cons, especially in countries where it's the norm, Western countries, I am not sure if I can wrap my brain around the idea of my mom turning into someone I see once a year, you know?
Yeah. Well,
I'm not the one to talk. I saw my mom last 2.5 years ago, but my circumstances were different. Exactly. I live in another country.
No, they,
I'm in the pandemic.
Yeah, they can, but they don't. That's a different story. So in the West, that's the mentality of people being raised with, that you can see them only on the weekends. Oh, when
that's still
like
okay.
Said, yeah, it's still.
And we
okay.
have hectic
not
lives.
Not really okay, but yeah.
We don't
okay.
need to see them every day.
Well, no one said every day, but at least, you know, you see, as kids, as sons and daughters ourselves, our relationship towards our parents is not the same as their relationship to us. The emotional feeling that we have towards them is not the same emotional feeling that they have toward us. So if I have, let's say, 10% feeling towards my dad or my mom would have 120 to
obviously it's her job because
so
she
she's constantly wants to see you. Even you say, look, you know what, if I see my once a week, I'm okay, you know,
but see
to them it's a different story.
Yeah,
so yeah. You need to give them,
you know what, now that I think about it, moving out makes both the parents and the children independent. Mm. Because a lot of parents are codependent on their children too, and it's not necessarily a healthy thing.
Well, that's a matter that
in a lot of parents
would look at.
Yeah, in a lot of parent-children relationship, it's the parents that have separation anxiety. It's the parents that are dependent. It's the parents that are attached.
Yeah.
And that's not healthy for either
parents,
of them.
Look, if the parents get too attached, obviously that's affecting the child. It will affect the child. Now, I think the hadith from Imam Sadiq salamullah alayhi, where he says, "Atrukuhum sab'an, adibuhum sab'an, allimuhum sab'an," and then, you know, like, leave them for 7, teach them for 7, befriend them for 7, then leave them when they get 21.
Mm.
Right. So I can understand from that hadith that at age 21, the child, if he spends 21 years of his life with his parents, he gets the proper vitamins and neutral, and what's the word?
Trainings, nutrients.
Huh? Nutrients. That are in the form of emotions. So he's emotionally ready, he's mentally ready, and after 21, you say, you know what?
Now go embark on your new journey.
That's it, you go, you have everything.
But or perhaps it means that up till the age of 21, do whatever training you want. When they're 21, there's no more training to be done.
Yeah, so
you can't like...
Exactly. So if we say if it's at 21 and it's past that age and the parents still wants to hold on to their kids and they are dependent
on them...
That's messed up. That's very messed up.
That's messed
up. It messes up the parents and the child.
Oh, yeah. That's all the time we have for today's episode. Sayyidina, as always, it's been a pleasure and an honor chatting with you and to y'all listening to us at home or in the car, at school. I hope it's not in class. Listen to your teacher. I leave you in the care and protection of the Almighty. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
I am what I am. Because you made, I have what I have. My love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you, I am braver, my defender and my savior, my giver and my taker. Abiding in silence with patience and guidance, aware when I need you, a light when I seek you, justice, forgiveness, the strength in my love is strong. Because you are the one I call creator, my Alpha and Omega, my protector and my maker. Because of you.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz for Indian subcontinent. And FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Heartbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.